Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Here's a quote to consider. The American dream should be the glue that holds us all together, a unifying vision that connects the many into one and forges a whole that is greater than its parts, unquote. Unfortunately, that's not the reality, but here's another quote. The first essential step to bringing our nation together is reimagining an American dream for our current times that meet the needs of all Americans, unquote. Now, both quotes are from the introduction to a new book by my guest, Bernie J. Mullen. He's author of Reimagining America's Dream, Making It Attainable for All. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. Bernie was CFO of the NBA. He was CEO of the NBA's Atlanta Spirit, the senior vice president of the Colorado Rockies, and was also a professor of business and sports management at the University of Massachusetts. He's now the CEO of a multi-billion dollar company. And Bernie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Ira, for having me on. One slight correction, I was CMO, chief marketing officer, not CFO.
Okay.
So, handle all the money. Handled all the team business.
Very good. All right. Well, I had one letter off, so that's not too bad.
No worry. That's pretty close. It's good enough.
Your book intrigues me because you are talking about the American dream. Is there a mutual understanding of what the American dream is? Because it used to be, if you grew up in various eras of American history, if you go back to the 40s and the 50s, and there was one concept, the American dream. When you get onto the 60s, you had the counterculture, and then you went into the 70s, the 80s, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in 2024, is there a mutual understanding of what the American dream is?
I don't believe there is.
And isn't that the problem?
We've lost it. Yeah. You know, I think we've lost it. You know, certainly in, the 30s, when the original concept of the American dream was devised, and like you said, 40s, 50s, 60s, certainly when I came here to live in the 70s, I think there was much more of a consensus. I think there was a slight feeling that it was very much about, you know, owning your own home and a little materialistic. But generally speaking, I think a lot of people realized that it was the pursuit of happiness and creating a better quality life for our kids and our grandkids.
What happened?
Well, I think a lot of things happened. I don't think it was ever really there for poor people and people with lower quality education. And unfortunately in this country, that means overwhelmingly the minorities are the majority of the poor people, although not necessarily. I mean, the largest group of poor people are rural white, in America. And I don't think for those folks, the dream was ever realistic. And the truth of the matter is, as we'll go through, some of the elements in the book, mm-hmm. What I do is I take the top 10 social issues in America, and those top 10 social issues as defined by Pew Research, post-voter polling research. You know, the economy is number one and education is number two. And in both those cases, there isn't the ability to generate wealth as much in the inner city for the poor and for those who have not had the quality education. So that's a large part of it. I also think there's a massive disconnect that we can talk about, not just the nasty, toxic divide we've got in politics from the extreme right to the extreme left, but perhaps best exemplified by that.
But what portion of this is a cultural issue? You mentioned about poor people. You mentioned in Appalachia, a lot of the poor whites, et cetera. And you look at other groups, you look at Asians, for example, Asian Americans, where there's a work ethic and there is a dedication to education. You are an immigrant. People came over and maybe the first generation worked very, very hard so their kids could go to school, a good school, learn, go to college, et cetera. Isn't a cultural aspect of this part of the puzzle?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And you've already pointed out that, unfortunately, it seems to be two cultures more than the others, certainly the African-American culture, and more, it didn't used to be the same with the Latino culture. but it's starting to get more and more that way. Certainly, it's not there for the South Asian culture, the Indians, the Pakistanis, or the Chinese that immigrants into this country. You know, if all you have to do is go to Ellis Island and you see what happened with the horrendous discrimination, starting with the Chinese that came to build the railroads, then, you know, then the Irish, then the Italians, and later the Costa Ricans, the Puerto Ricans, and Central and South Americans. So there's always been tremendous differences. And, you know, for whatever the reason, and, you know, I've been a big champion of diversity in the professional sports teams and colleges where I have worked, and in my own company that I built, we've been very successful. But there is a feeling, particularly for African-American community, that it goes back to slavery and goes back to the emasculation of the American male through that slavery, that I think certainly members of the African-American community don't believe that they've been able to fully recover from. And obviously, incidents like George Floyd and many of the other incidents that's happened in the last 5 years are certainly taken as illustrations of that. And we could argue whether that's fair, real, appropriate or not, but it's a fact within the mindset of those communities that we have to operate from.
Well, but it's also a fact that you have very successful Black politicians, Black government leaders, Black actors, Black sports figures, etc. So you have a substantial amount of people who come from that culture that succeed greatly. So is it, in fact, in a way, aren't we painting a broad brush towards what you, as you refer to, the African-American community, when in fact, it's a segment of that community, not the entire community?
Without a shadow of a doubt. You know, and living as I've done in Atlanta for 19 years, I've just moved back to Denver, Colorado, where my kids and grandkids are. And, you know, certainly you can see that. I'm in probably one of the most affluent African-American communities in the world. And I think parts of that is, as you dig deeper, because stereotypes don't work and broad brush generalizations don't work either. But as you dig deep, sports and entertainment is totally a meritocracy. You got game, you play. You don't got game, you don't play. You know, so without a shadow of a doubt, those are areas, particularly music industry, entertainment industry, living in Atlanta, you know, with Tyler Perry, Usher, Big Boy, Outkast, Ludacris, you know, all of the people that Jane Fonda, who I met with while I was there, did a fabulous job of really helping, you know, the movie industry and the TV documentary industry, all of the economic incentives that the city of Atlanta put in place so that they now rival Hollywood. Great examples of that. It's, you know, obviously, Jesse Jackson, in his younger career, made the statement that said, you may be down and you're disadvantaged because you're Black, but if you stay there, it is your choice. And that is what we have to strive for, is providing those opportunities. And within that, I think that one of the first things we need to do is have a dose of realism. And the dose of realism is that so much of our discussion is about equality, equality, equality. And I think what certain institutions, particularly some politicians, not all, is the entitlement game is actually debilitating. So I throw out to you, you know, a controversial statement, but I would say to you that the idea that, this is very much in Georgia, the idea that voters must show their ID to vote is racist, you know, but not the way it's being portrayed. You know, the idea that most African Americans don't have a driver's license is insulting and racist. Of course they do. You know, they needed to go to the doctors, they needed to go for, you know, sign a check and all the other things. So why the hell would they turn around and use that as an excuse? I mean, so many of the entitlement programs, and not just Black community, the entire community that receives these programs are not programs designed as a hand up they're designed as a handout, and they create a continued ongoing dependency, which is, I think, in itself inherently racist or discriminatory against people who are poor, less educated, etc. And it's counterproductive. So I think that's where we have to start, is stop doing that and stop making the statements and all the other BS that, in my opinion, that supports that mental thinking.
Well, it sounds like, because in the book you talk about why generational wealth is so critical for our future, and yet what you just described is what I would call generational non-wealth, because these programs continue on to other generations instead of encouraging the next generation to do things, to be productive, to start a business, to work.
Absolutely, Ira. They actually support generational poverty. They're doing the exact opposite of what people say are the benefits of those programs. So what am I coming from in the book? I'm coming from, you know, what my dad taught me were two big things. Number one, elbow grease. You never hear that phrase anymore. Okay. Eight years old, I washed his car, you know, and when I was done, he was a sergeant major in the Army and a boxer. Okay. So when I went to my dad, it was, please, yes, sir, I have finished your car. He brings me out, goes under the bumper, rubs my nose in the dirt because I'm washed under the bumper. 8 years old. Today, he would be arrested for child abuse. But that was tough love. And you know what? He raised a kid who worked his butt off all my life and all my career to become the first immigrant, the first foreigner ever to run a major league team. And I ran two of them, the Atlanta Hawks NBA team, the Atlanta Thrashers NHL team, as they were in those days. So that's number one, hard work. Number two, honesty and integrity. You know, when I was about 6 years old, I and my neighbor friend climbed over the fence into my aunt's backyard, stole some apples and ate them. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I threw up. They were baking apples. I didn't know there were such things as baking apples. You can't eat them raw. You got to cook them. So, you know, first of all, I lied about where I got the apples from, you know, and then when found out, I then gave the truth, pointed the finger at my friend as being older than me, and therefore he had to be the one that led me to do it, when it was all my idea. You know, my dad took me to my friend's house, and he goes, it was his idea. So two whoops of the belt on the butt for stealing, two for lying, and two for pointing the finger at someone else, twice the punishment for other than the stealing act. So I learned those values. That's what's missing, not just in poor and low quality education homes, in all homes in America. We have a trophy generation. You get a participation trophy. What kind of baloney is that? That's not America. We're in the Olympics right now. Okay? You know, in the Olympics, you get a gold and a silver and a bronze, and I would have been more than ecstatic to win a silver or bronze. But in life, striving to be the best is what this country is all about. It's what I've experienced for 51 years. I'm so blessed and so grateful, but it's what we need to bring back.
It's part of the problem, because I just looking at it as objectively as I can, the things that you and I were taught as kids in public education, not private, in public education, there were such things as civics classes. There were other classes that emphasized your roles and responsibilities growing up in a society, in a free society. It doesn't seem to be that in the school systems in America anymore. Maybe I'm just not seeing it and it exists, but from what I see and what I see reports of teachers and what they're emphasizing rather than the basics, I'm sure this would be a Bernie quote, reading, writing, and arithmetic. What, you know, the basic stuff that you would learn, it's more ideological material rather than just practical material. And maybe there needs to be as well less emphasis, I hate to say it because I'm a liberal arts major, less emphasis on liberal arts and more emphasis on trades, repair, fixing things, making things work, fixing things that don't work, and having that mindset in general towards society.
I couldn't agree with you more, Ira. You know, whether it's public school or vocational schools, it doesn't matter. You know, the three R's was what was drilled into me. I happened to be a Catholic Christian, so I went to Catholic school with the nuns, you know, in grade school, and I went with the Irish Christian Brothers in high school, middle school and high school. Doesn't matter. You know, leave aside the religion. You know, you got whacked into line, and I'm not advocating that, and I'm not suggesting that everybody needs my dad to rub their nose in the dirt under the bumper. But what it was your word was your bond. And, you know, you had to work hard. And the fundamental thing is discipline. From my friends, we have a lot of people in our family, extended family, who are teachers. And what do they tell me more than anything else? There's no support from the parents. The parents are sending the kids to school to get disciplined, to be parented, you know, because they've advocated many of the social responsibilities as a parent. They want to be the kids' friends. That's not good. Let them have friends their age. That's what friends are.
Yeah.
You know, parents are parents. Here's the line. As a young professional, when I left being an academic at the University of Massachusetts after 10 years there in Amherst, I started with the Pirates. And I was terrified because I wasn't sure that I deserved to be there as an executive. And so I listened to Zig Ziglar, positive motivational speaker, every morning. He tells a great story about the Alabama grade school that was built, and they opened it up in the spring semester, and they'd not finished the wall around the school. So there was a blacktop, and then there was grass, but there was no wall. All the kids went to recess and huddled on the blacktop. Then over the summer, they built the wall. Come back in the fall, the kids go all the way onto the grass, the full playground of the school, right up to the wall. And Zig asks the fundamental question, is that wall freeing or is it confining? And this is what we need to teach to parents. The wall is freeing. Okay, you will be home by 11 o'clock as a 15-year-old. You know, that's a party with potential for drugs and alcohol. I will not let you go to that party. Okay, I'll be the meanie, but draw the line. Keep the line consistent, make it fair and reasonable. But that's what kids need and want. And I think from what my friends in the educational system are, you know, teaching them or allowing them to define their pronouns at ridiculously young ages, I don't see the benefit of that versus teaching them how to read, write, because I was a professor for 10 years. And the grammar I got from some of the undergraduates in my classes was beyond brutal bad.
Well, then I guess the question is, the critical question is, your vision for a United American concept here, or a United American dream probably would be a better term, that, because that's part of your book, obviously, your book title. But can you turn it around, just going on that one small slice of what we've been talking about, public education? Somehow these teachers that are teaching today are teaching things that weren't taught before, or are not teaching the things that need to be taught. Where does that turnaround come from? Is it, again, you say maybe from the parents putting pressure on the school district, but if the parents are kids themselves and want to send their kids to school just for discipline, how do you break that cycle?
Well, there's two recommendations here, Ira, and I don't pretend to know everything, but you know, we've done a lot of research, talked to a lot of people who are experts in the field. You know, I was an expert in higher education, having been taught at the university for 10 years. But down in the grade schools, where does it start? It starts at birth. So one of the things I've done, all the proceeds from the book, all the proceeds from my management consulting, go to the Aspire Difference Foundation. We're focused on single parents, caregivers, with preschool kids. So let's start with what we recommend in the book. Free preschool for every child in America. I mean, it's a lot of money. I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously billions of dollars, but it's no more than we're investing right now in Israel, Gaza, and Ukraine annually. It's about the same amount of money for free preschool for the 4 million American kids that are born every year. So 20 million kids when all 5 years are in preschool. What does that do? It gives, so let's go back to that single parent mom. who's making 20 something thousand in the first job, has to do a second job, and then has to pay for a daycare. She's putting them in a neighbor home that may or may not be quality education, probably isn't. And that's an extra 10 grand a year minimum. So now we give them $30,000 minimum wage. So we get the dignity that any person, and, you know, Kamala Harris has this as part of her campaign, and I'm not endorsing one candidate over the other, but that's part of her campaign, that we need to have free preschool for every child, not just poor people, every child, quality education, so that when they go into kindergarten, they can read, write, do basic math. All the research studies show that by third grade, a child not reading at third grade will stay behind educationally their entire career, and their probability of getting into social problems such as crime and being incarcerated, teenage pregnancy, alcohol, drug addiction, and other social negatives is 4 to 5 times that of a child that can read and write. So we start there. Then we do babysitting in school for the 1 in 5 American kids who are latchkey kids right now. Free babysitting for them. They stay in school. So these are the kids with the highest risk. And these are the kids that if they stay in school, we bring back former school teachers or substitute teachers or people who are qualified to help them do their homework in school. They get a late activity bus back home so they're not a latchkey kid. Massive difference, again, free. Then where the program really kicks in is we're recommending a boot camp at age 13 or 14, rising freshmen go for an 8-week sleepaway camp. I ran summer camps. In fact, it's how I came to the United States, was to be a soccer counselor, a head soccer counselor, the head group counselor for kids in a very wealthy camp up in Maine. So I did that for 11 years. I know how to run these camps. I know how to run them efficiently, and I know what to do with them. We teach these kids how to be an adult. 8 weeks, they get paid, and they live black, brown, yellow, all the religions, all the ethnicities, rich or whatever, together. And they're taught how to be an adult. John F. Kennedy asked not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for it. That whole approach. And they have to exercise every morning. There are no phones, no mobile devices. Every Sunday night for a couple of hours, they go into a lab and get unlocked. That's it. I mean, the culture shock would be amazing, but to get them to learn how to unite, that it's about other people, not all about you. And it's about learning the responsibility and discipline of an adult. Then before sophomore, junior, and senior years, you work in a summer experience, 8 weeks, get paid the minimum wage, at least. So by the time you're 18, you would have a CV, curriculum vitae, or a resume with 4 years of work experience. You better know what you want to do in terms of the career you want to go for, the major you want to study. And you would have $5 grand a year, 20,000. Plus, I'll go to banks. I've done this all my career. I'll go to banks and get them to give 7.5% interest to any kid who leaves all the money in the bank for those years. No deductions, no tax, no social security, nothing. What that means is an 18-year-old would have $25,000 cash. We create generational wealth in half a generation or two-thirds of a generation. They then would get free college or professional certification, $15,000 up to $15,000 a year, voucher for 4 years, $60,000 total. A 25-year-old kid would have a college degree, a professional certification, no student debt, and whatever $25,000 in the bank had been invested in, whether real estate or whether in an entrepreneurial business of their choice. That is how we change the mainstream of America. It takes a long time. Mm-hmm. It could be, you know, if we're talking 2-3 years to set it up for a 14-year-old, you know, then we're talking about 12, 13 years from now. But that is half a generation. We can make a massive difference. I just need a politician to hire. You know, people like yourself with your pulpit to get the message out.
Well, the important question is, having listened to you just now and all the steps involved, is it doable from your point of view?
It's very doable. You know, I mean, it's obviously hundreds of billions of dollars, without a shadow of a doubt,
right,
invested by the federal government, you know, in the free preschool. Local school districts can kick in with the Latchkey Kids support. The federal government would need to do the boot camp, and businesses would need to do the sophomore, junior, and senior year employment. So it's right. All doable. And like I said, it's costed out, you know, and the Office of Management and Budget can cost it out. It is an investment equal to what we're spending right now to try and save the rest of the world from communist influence and communist rule. And I'm not saying we should stop doing that, because I know how important that is. But why wouldn't we make this extra investment in our youth?
Looking at it that way, are you optimistic or pessimistic that this can be done? Not so much that it's doable, which it can be done, but it has to have willpower, it has to have political leadership, it has to have commitment of funds, et cetera. Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Semi-optimistic.
That's fair. That's rational and realistic. Okay.
Yeah. And that's based upon one thing about the book, Rad. Reimagining America's Dream subliminally is Rad. R-A-D. R stands for Republicans, D stands for Democrats, and A stands for the 65% of Americans, according to Pew Research, who are centrists, moderates, independents, like myself. And it's a question of, do the A, all of us in the middle, stand up and start shouting and screaming to the level of the shouting and screaming we're getting from the extreme right or we're getting from the extreme left right now? We have to nullify the extremities and the insanity that is going on. You know, the insanity of a debate that you as a teacher can allow a child to redefine their pronouns and you don't ought to have to communicate that change with the parents.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's an amazing
fundamental responsibility. I mean, We've talked at length about parents are abdicating responsibility for their kids. So now we're going to reinforce that?
Mm-hmm. I understand exactly what you're saying. Yeah,
my heart bleeds for any kid who has gender dysphoria. I cannot imagine what it'd be like. You know, I'm straight. My ex-wife is gay. I have many gay friends. I understand the stress and pressure they're under in society, and I think it's getting better. And I think the younger generation is so much better than my generation were with these social changes. But the bottom line is, yeah, I'm optimistic, but only if we get middle-of-the-road politicians. Look at our choices for this November election. You know, an extreme right, an extreme left. You know, by most people's views, you know, a little different with Biden, you know, withdrawing from the race. But you look at it and say, where are the centrist, moderate voices? Because this stuff makes so much sense. We used to do boot camp, literal boot camp. At age 18, every male had to go to military conscription, you know, for many years. My generation in England was 2 years after it stopped. You know, in retrospect, I wish I'd gone through it. This is in place of it. It's not about guns. It's not about programming our kids in anything other than be everything you can be. And the controversial message has to be, yes, you are equal under the eyes of the creator, whatever you believe the creator to be. If it's the universe, we're all equal. We're all equal under the law as citizens and residents of the United States. We're all equal. But the truth is, we were all given very equal talents. You know, I am a different physical size, same sex as you are, but I'm not a woman. You know, I'm not transgender. And I'm not LeBron. Boy, did I wish I could have been LeBron. I wanted to be a professional footballer, soccer player, but I'm not LeBron. And he's really smart and intelligent. He's got a boatload of tremendous gifts, but I'm not him. Never will be him. Ain't going to be fighting for a gold medal in Olympic basketball. But I do have great strengths as a marketer, as a communicator. I believe that that's what God gave me. In my case, I believe it's God. And in my case, I felt I had the responsibility to use all those talents to the fullest.
Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Bernie J. Mullen. He's author of Reimagining America's Dream, Making It Attainable for All. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places. Bernie, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Ira. Anybody wants to contact me individually, Bernie.Mullen at playfly.com. Happy to talk, and certainly we need to get those influences and the politicos moving in the right direction. Thanks again, Ira.
Thank you, and join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.